Welcome, Professor Hathaway.
Well, it's an absolute joy to be here.
Tell me, first, how many of these plants were there across the United States?
That's a bone of contention. Hathaway says there were as many as 52,000. The Environmental Protection Agency was feeling very comfortable with 1,500 and then has begrudgingly moved up to 5,000. But I'll guarantee there are plenty of them.
What leads you to believe that there might have been more than 50,000 of these sites around North America? And where would they have been? In cities? Out in the country? Tell me about these.
Most of the plants were congregated around people because they served human interests. They served people. They served industry. By far the largest number of manufactured gas plants made what is called producer gas. And it became quite fashionable economically for American industry from about 1890 to about 1940 to have their own gasworks at the plant. Every Army post, every naval installation, after about 1880, had gasworks. And that was because they were outside of town, and the soldiers deserved reading lamps and reading lights as much as anyone else. Institutions, homes for children, homes for the infirm, hospitals, places for dependent population had gasworks. There were gasworks in colleges and schools and seminaries, hotels and resorts. It goes on and on.
Here it is, the year 2001. How do you identify the sites contaminated by gasworks?
There are several places that we go to look, and we should look at all times. The first one is called Brown's Directory of North American Gas Companies. It's been around since 1887, and with the exception of 5 years in the 1890s, it has been published annually. Next, we have the fabulous collection of fire insurance maps that were generated by Daniel Sanborn of Chelsea, Massachusetts, who began his product in 1863. Not all gasworks, especially the producer plants for fuel, are shown on the Sanborn maps, but virtually all of the municipal or town-type gasworks are.
This was a pretty simple process, right? You just kind of take the coal and you roast it, and out comes the gas that you can use for lamps and that sort of thing.
Oh, yes. There were some later changes, but that's how it started.
There are a bunch of steps that the gas plants use to purify the manufactured gas that they got from heating up the coal. Can you quickly walk me through what some of the byproducts would have been from those processes?
The first thing is, as you roast the coal to make the illuminating gas, you produce tar. And then beyond that, you have cyanide, and you tend to have sulfur and arsenic and other heavy metals left over from the coal. And you're absolutely correct on it, Steve. The gas had to be cleaned up so that it could be used in the home or business or street lamps.
And the result was not a very healthy mixture of things, I guess.
Not at all. They're called PAHs today, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon.
What did the companies typically do with all this waste?
The wastes could have been, at many times and places, byproducts with a value, and in which case they were essentially recycled and either used at the plant or sold for the world's chemical industry, which was coal tar based until 1920. Now, there's others of the residuals were indeed wastes. There's nothing you can do with cyanide. The sulfur was sometimes trapped and used to create vitriol, which we know today as sulfuric acid. And there's really nothing you can do with the arsenic because it's in relatively small amounts.
Typically, what would happen to the cyanide and arsenic and the other toxic stuff that couldn't be used by industry here?
Well, there were two streams. First of all, the tars that couldn't or weren't used by industry were often dumped. They could, in almost all cases, however, at the gasworks, be used with care as a fuel to fire the furnaces underneath the retorts that made the coal gas as fuel. That was possible. some of the tar was a sort of off-spec in the sense that it had what we would loosely call dirt in it. Coal has the minerals feldspar and quartz, which are refractory. They don't burn, and they come out as ash. And some of that, in very, very fine particles, gets caught up in the tar and forms a sludge in the bottom of the tar tanks. And the people who would buy the tar, the great tar distilleries, wouldn't take the sludge. And so that was a waste.
How much of the cyanide and the sulfuric acid and the arsenic do you think was just dumped on the ground or put into nearby riverways back in the days when this business was going?
Unfortunately, a considerable amount. Now, when I say that, I mean a considerable amount in the sense that we should be concerned about it today. And that has to be, quite frankly, explored and determined at every one of these former gasworks sites. And if the people in charge of the characterization of the site and its waste don't do that, then there's absolutely no rational basis to do anything with a site, let alone make risk assessments.
Well, let me ask you this. These plants stopped manufacturing gas from coal, in the 1950s? How much of a problem are these byproducts 50 years later?
Just as much as a problem as they were at the time the plants were in operation, because of the fact that coal tar has a geologic life. It never goes away.
I imagine there were some major industrial-scale gas works in some places and a lot of small ones, and that a lot of the big sites may yet still be occupied by offshoots of the companies that were making the gas 50, 100, 150 years ago. If these are still in industrial areas, how is all this tar waste and other toxins a problem for human health today?
There's an interaction between the tar source area such that that is wed intimately with the geologic detail underneath the ground, which is always complex. On top of that, or I should say woven into that matrix, is the groundwater. And sometimes this groundwater is perched or it's found above the groundwater surface. And the tar, universally, as it lasts forever and doesn't degrade, also tended to move into a position in the ground where it had an equilibrium of energy. In other words, gravity pulling down on it, and interparticle forces with the soil and the presence of water and so forth, it would come to rest. And I've got to make the point here that the incomplete combustion of organic material will produce tar made up of compounds in the range of 300 to 5,000 separate polycyclical aromated hydrocarbon compounds. And they are co-soluble and co-miscible. So they all come to rest together in this generally black gooey mass around which every drop of water then that comes into contact will solubilize to the degree of its chemistry and its residence time and passing by in groundwater flow. So we have that problem. And then we have the problem of this contaminated water breaking out into the environment along sides of gullies, streams, and creeks. Sometimes, as is in the case of St. Louis, Missouri, and the great gas works there, sometimes the sewage, and when I say sewerage, in other words, sewer pipes, will pick up leaks, and they'll leak in groundwater from the outside or contaminated groundwater or even coal tar sometimes. And then that will follow the sewer down to whatever point it is that that's released. And not all of the sewers go to the wastewater plant. Some of them will go directly into the river, for instance. So it just gets around. And then, of course, it gets into the food chain.
What links have been made between these plants and illnesses that people are reporting?
Now, I want to say that I'm not a toxicologist and I'm not a medical doctor. I have a doctorate in geology and engineering. So I want to say that I speak as an informed scientist and engineer. We know from health studies from the last 150, 160 years that there is an association with coal tar and the presence of various forms of cancer. That has been proven. The first of that literature began with the description of testicular cancer occurring in the bodies of chimney sweeps in London, 1810. There are certain cancer clusters that have occurred around former manufactured gas plant sites. The most notable are the cancers that caused the litigation and trials over the gas works at Taylorville, Illinois. And this was, I believe, neuroblastoma, but again, I'm not a medical doctor.
I'm wondering, how aware were the gas work companies that the stuff that they were either piling up on their land or throwing into nearby streams or wetlands was really unhealthy for people and the environment?
All we have to do, Steve, is to go to their literature.
Okay.
And it says that they knew about it. They were aware of the fact that whenever you discharged any of these gas house wastes to the ground, that you got yourself in trouble. And this begins to show in the form of various laws around the turn of the century. In fact, C.P. Greenough wrote an entire book in 1883, published in Boston, on the liabilities of the gas business.
I take it that landowners, neighbors, want this stuff cleaned up when they find out about it. What's the typical cost to remediate a contaminated site?
Well, we can say it's gonna cost a few million dollars upward.
Now, court cases like the one in Wisconsin are becoming more common. I'm wondering, how much does all this litigation add to these considerable cleanup costs?
The litigation, yes, does add to them, but I think we have to put this in the proper perspective, and that is that under the Superfund law, the responsible parties, those entities that remain associated with the entities that operated the plants at the time the waste was generated and discharged the ground, are still present and should be involved in the, shall we say, the financing of these cleanups, because it was those entities that actually benefited from the process. And the fact, in many states, the utility industry has been allowed to collect monies from rate adjustments from their clientele.
In these cases that involve utilities and insurance companies, what's at issue here in terms of cleaning up the waste from these gas plants?
Yes, there's a tremendous struggle going on now in which the owners, and I don't want to just characterize the owners as the utility industry, I'm just going to say any potentially responsible party who happens to own a gasworks site and in a corporate sense is still connected with the gas-making operation, they have been looking at their insurance carriers, generally speaking, in the range of the late 1930s, and this is my own experience, the late 1930s through sometimes into the 60s. And the premise is that the insurance carrier wrote coverage for general accident liability, and that the condition of environmental threat that is recognized by the state environmental agency or the federal government, the region of EPA, is due to unspecified accidents that occurred since the plant shut down and was no longer making gas. But in that period of time, these plaintiffs contend that accidents under the purview or the coverage of the insurance company's contract caused the situation that is now being ordered for remediation. And of course, the insurance companies are not willing to accept that premise, especially on the basis of the fact that most of these plants were not operating at the time of their coverage.
Who do you think is going to end up footing the bill for all this remediation?
I believe that if the federal government and the states do not continue to move forward in prosecuting this, the changing face of the utility industry, which we see as a blur now because of the rapidity in which these companies are morphing, changing their shapes and their names, it's going to fall to the taxpayer, because I will bring back again the fact the tar will never go away.
Alan Hathaway is a retired geology professor from the University of Missouri. His book on manufactured gas and its legacy will come out later this year. Thank you so much, Professor Hathaway.
You're entirely welcome, sir.